security who lied beside the boy of blessed purity, the little boy with midnight in his hair and diamonds in his eyes.
Diamonds. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
On the next all-new Voices for the Animals, it's part two of our coverage of the crisis at the Multnomah County Animal Shelter. We'll be speaking with Aaron Grayhack, the newest director of Multnomah County Animal Services, about the problems at the shelter, her response to the issues raised by volunteers in part one of this series, and most importantly, plans to improve conditions and operations at the shelter moving forward.
We have trust building to do with volunteer corps. If you've talked with some of them, then, I think that's a thing we're aware of and are working to rebuild and regain that trust that has suffered over a number of years.
Join me, Michelle Coppola, on Voices for the Animals, Friday, April 28th at 10 a.m. here on 90.7 KBOO FM.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning into KBOO Portland.
If you stop to listen, you can hear their hearts beating loud. Can't keep those California Indians down.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. For Marcus Lopez, I'm your host, Larry Smith.
An apology is a performance unless it's backed by some action. Unless there's some accountability, then an apology is weak. And in this particular case, it felt like a slap in the face because it doesn't have any action associated with it. And we're talking about huge trauma. I mean, the reality is that we're all still living within the manifestations of intergenerational trauma. How dare somebody say they're sorry and not immediately ask what can we do to restore balance? What can we do to make things right?
Today on American Indian Airwaves, an in-depth interview on a Chumash scholar's perspective of Pope Francis's recent apology to Indigenous peoples and the respective First Nations within Canada for its complicity and legacy in committing acts of cultural genocide during the residential school era. All that and more here on American Indian Airwaves.
You can hear when the moon shines bright, the lone fool in the black of the night. You can hear the whisper in the valley. And you know when Kamakani blows to the bahu drum, it's the warriors who are marching down the mountain. Because history ain't no mystery to me.
On July 25th of 2022, Pope Francis apologized to Canada's Indigenous peoples on their land for the church's role in residential schools where Indigenous children were starved, beaten for speaking their Indigenous languages, violently and sexually abused, and endured various forms of forced cultural assimilation, such as mandatory Christianization, plus more, in what Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission called cultural genocide. The address to the First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples was the first apology on Canadian soil by the Pope as part of a tour to heal deep wounds that rose to the fore after the discovery of unmarked graves at residential schools. It's estimated that between 1881 and 1996, more than 150,000 Indigenous children were separated from their families and brought to residential schools that were sanctioned by the Canadian government and operated by various Christian missionaries. In the United States, Native American nations, communities, and families endured a similar fate as Indigenous peoples in Canada, beginning with the Indian Civilization Act Fund of 1819 and the Peace Policy of 1869, and with the urging of several denominations of the Christian Church, the U.S. government adopted an Indian boarding school policy expressly intended to implement cultural genocide against all Indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations. Between 1869 and the 1960s, hundreds of thousands of Native American children were forcefully removed from their homes and families and placed in boarding schools operated by the federal government and the churches. In fact, by 1926, nearly 83% of Indian school-aged children were attending boarding schools. There's been a lot of discussion and reactions to the Pope's apology, but what does the Pope's apology mean for Indigenous peoples? Will the Vatican do more besides apologize, ask for forgiveness, or will there be substantial actions holding the Vatican accountable for its violent colonial legacy of cultural genocide still impacting Indigenous peoples today? In today's program, Marcus Lopez, co-host and executive producer of American Indian Airwaves, interviews Dr. Dina Dart about what the Pope's apology means from one Indigenous perspective, and what does that mean for California Indigenous peoples and the role the Vatican played in its legacy of genocide. Dr. Dina Dart is a member of the Coastal Band of the Chumash Nation, the former curator of the Native American Collection at Portland Art Museum, and the founder of Live Oak Museum Consulting, based out of Eugene, Oregon, an organization committed to reshaping museum narratives and assisting institutions in their efforts to be more accountable and responsive to Native American communities. This is Marcus Lopez speaking with Dr. Dina Dart on the significance and complications in the Pope's apologies in the violent legacy of Canada's residential and U.S. boarding schools.
The Pope visits Canada, Indigenous people looking for action. The Pope visit reflects many different issues regarding the Catholic Church as well as Indigenous people. The last papal visit to Canada was Pope John Paul II in 2002. Survivors and leaders of Indigenous communities say that they want financial compensation, artifact recovery, support in bringing in alleged abusers to justice, and the release of records relating to the schools which operated between 1831 and 1996. Some Indigenous leaders also want the Catholic Church to rescind and renounce a 15th-century colonial doctrine that justified dispossessing Indigenous people issue as papal bull or edicts. These papal bulls open up the archives for survivors to find their families and to piece together what happened in the schools. In addition to that, Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops promised to raise $30 million for healing, culture and language revitalization, and other incentives. But within that, many Indigenous people ask themselves, and that is, in 2000, October 12, Pope John Paul's second great jubilee year, the Day of Pardon, he was presented on the 508th anniversary of Christopher Columbus' arrival in the New World, quote-unquote, that to rescind the 1493 papal bull called Intra Criteria. And this was a reflection of about the rescinding the doctrine and all the following doctrines or earlier doctrines like Dum Diversas 1452 and Romanus Pontifex the 1455, along with the doctrine of discovery, main one, and that is the doctrine Intra Soteria. So we see that a lot of discussions have been in the last few weeks regarding the Catholic Church and the Pope's visit. This reflects the long permanent reminder of this oppression. We are going to have an interview with Professor Dina Dart, PhD, Chumash person from Santa Barbara, on the question of the Pope's visit and what that means to us. Her scholarly and professional work strives to address the incongruities between public understanding, representation, and true acknowledgement in Native peoples, their culture, histories, and contemporary lives. She earned her MA and PhD from the University of Oregon and has held positions in Burke Museum of Natural and Cultural History and the Portland Art Museum, as well as teaching appointments at the University of Oregon, University of Washington, Northwest Indian College. She recently completed a writing fellowship at the School of Advanced Research, where she revised her book, manuscripts, and publication titled Subverting the Master Narrative, Museums, Power, Native Life in California. Dina serves on the board of Oregon's Museum Association and Confluence Project. Dina Dart has Live Oak Consulting. You can look that up at liveoaknative.com. And her particular list of publications is Subverting the Dominant Narrative, like I said before, Reclaiming the Camino in Our Times, and Visualizing Genocide. Dina Dart and Mike Murawski, Objective Stories, Connecting Collections with Communities, California Sites of Consciousness, Analysis of Mission Museums Narrative, Museum Anthropology, Volume 34, and in 2006, Dina Dart and John Ehrlichson, Little Choice for the Chumash Cattle, Colonialism and Coercion in the Mission Period, Santa Barbara, on the American Indian Quarterly. Now, without further ado, let's get with the interview with Professor and Dr. Dina Dart. Thank you, Dina Dart, for being on the American Indian Airwaves. We have just recently been presented with a visitation from in northern continent of the Pope of the Vatican, Pope Francis. And that, to me, goes into the question of he still have an outstanding and unanswered question to the not only the Chumash or California Indians, if you will, of what you were part of the panel discussion on the disrobing Sarah, but that effort and your expertise of not only Chumash history, but the culture expresses certain things. So I think, first of all, it's a long intro. The Pope came to Canada. What's your first impressions?
Well, first of all, thanks, Marcus, for asking me to be on your show. You're somebody who I respect and admire greatly, and who's done so much for our community and raising the visibility of Native issues in California and beyond. So thank you. It's always an honor to collaborate with you. And yeah, we collaborated on the Junipero Serra canonization a few years ago, and the outrage that was felt and expressed among California Indian people at that notion. And you organized a gathering and a panel discussion about why that the idea of making Junipero Serra a saint was a ridiculous notion. He was essentially the architect of genocide in California, and we are still, you know, reeling and trying to heal and trying to come back from that. You know, while most of us along the mission trail were so devastated by the impacts of the missions that we lost our languages, we lost most of the aspects of our culture, our traditional cultures, our traditional ecological knowledge. And, you know, it's miraculous, but most of our communities now are coming back from that, you know, 250 years later, and cobbling together our cultures and our languages and even our traditional ecological knowledge, but devastating impacts, right? The Catholic Church wreaked havoc in the Americas, and an apology is a very, by one person, an apology by one person is an insult of the largest kind. I recognize that Pope Francis is a liberal, you know, seemingly good-hearted fellow, maybe the most open-minded of the popes to date. However, An apology is a performance unless it's backed by some action. There was no discussion of the rescinding of the doctrine of discovery, even though that has been resoundingly the most important action that could be taken by the Catholic Church. Just a statement that they rescind the doctrine of discovery, that they recognize the damage the doctrine of discovery has done, you know, sort of leading the way for U.S. and Canadian policy in regards to Native people and land. The doctrine of discovery still informs law, you know, on a national level in Canada and the U.S. And so just that a statement could have gone so far, right? He or the Catholic Church, probably more like the Catholic Church, not allowing him to actually speak those words, because I don't imagine that he acts as a sole individual decision maker. He still has to, you know, align with the beliefs of all of his contemporaries, the other cardinals. But not only was, you know, rescinding or a revocation of the doctrine of discovery not done, there were no statements of subsequent actions that the Catholic Church would take in terms of restoring, returning objects and human remains that are held at the Vatican, or turning over some of the land.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Dr. Dina Dart, a member of the Coastal Band of the Chumash Nation, on the Pope's recent apology to Indigenous peoples up in Canada for the Canadian government and the Church's role in its legacy of residential schools and cultural genocide, and what the apology means in terms of its significance and complications for Indigenous peoples. You're listening to One California Indigenous Perspective on the Pope's apology. And now back to the interview.
And we're talking about Canada, right? The Pope hasn't come here and to talk to California Indian people, but these are the same things that, you know, that we would be asking for. You know, somebody posted on Facebook, it might have been L. Frank or Wishoyot Alvitri, maybe Cindy Alvitri, one of the Tongva strong, you know, activist community members in the Tongva community, said that the cape that belonged to Juana Maria, the last woman found on San Nicolas Island, was sent to the Vatican. You know, so these things that are really precious, ceremonial, sacred objects are held by the Catholic Church in the Vatican with no use. What is the Catholic Church going to do with Juana Maria's cape? If, you know, those kinds of things would not be a hardship for them to return to California Indian people to curate and care for and return into ceremony. I mean, it's really simple actions that could be taken rather than just the performance of reconciliation. We don't want an apology unless, of course, it's backed by a whole plan of action about how to reconcile, how to restore balance to these places that have been so destabilized, so, you know, in some cases completely destroyed. I mean, it's as I said a minute ago, you know, it's miraculous that we are still, that you and I are still identifying as Chumash and still claim those homelands as ours, that we're still doing things to maintain our culture in that place and to perpetuate our lifeways and our values in that place. It is a miracle, right? We don't have land. We don't have any resources. We don't have, you know, we don't have the support of the federal or even the state government. And those coastal tribes, not only the Chumash, but the Ohlone and Salinan, the Esalen, the Tongva, the Juanenyo, all of these tribes that were so devastated by the missions are still miraculously, you know, hanging on and preserving and protecting those homelands and practicing even more strongly now than ever our cultural lifeways, but with no help, with zero help from the government, zero help from the church, right? I suspect, Marcus, I've never talked to you about this, but I just learned that several of my ancestors are buried in a cemetery in Montecito, an unmarked cemetery that's actually owned by the diocese. And Teresa Romero and I were talking about is it possible to get the local diocese to transfer that land ownership over to the coastal band or to a coastal groups or at least a group of us that have ancestors in that cemetery? What business does the Catholic Church have owning that piece of land? It's completely unmarked. They're not caring for it. So it's in complete disrepair. There are only like 5 headstones that are visible. The first thing we need to do is ground penetrating radar and locate where all the graves are. And then, but they're not doing that. So, you know, those are the kinds of things. I mean, we have a whole raft of actions that we could present to the Catholic Church if they actually seemed amenable to put their, you know, their money and their power where their mouth is. That's my feeling about it. Maybe more words than you anticipated. But one thing that you and I talked about yesterday was this, you know, the idea of the land acknowledgement being just, you know, just one more performative box checking kind of thing. And that's what this feels like too, you know. Unless there are actions, unless there's some accountability, then an apology is weak. And in this particular case, it felt like a slap in the face because it doesn't have any action associated with it. And we're talking about huge trauma. I mean, the reality is that we're all still, you know, living within the manifestations of intergenerational trauma. We're still reeling. You know, how dare somebody say they're sorry and not. And then not immediately ask what can we do to restore balance? What can we do to make things right? That's the way that I was taught to apologize. You know, you don't just say you're sorry. You say, you know, I take responsibility for my actions. And in so doing, I'm going to ask you, what can we do together to restore balance and healing? In this place where I have caused damage, you know, that's an apology. You know, we know that. We know our manners, Marcus. this guy apparently doesn't.
That's so important because even within that particular doctrine of Catholicism, there's ways to create some atonement. And that's what you're talking about in their language. Well, I think what you're talking to is get some respect for the people, first people of the land, and mm-hmm. what their history is, and just uncover this truth, this untold truth. I'm going to read something to you from Kara McWilliams, North of Mexico. And because I think one of the things you're talking about is the performance. And you are, and the reason I want to talk with you is because you've examined this performance of history and how ridiculous it is, which I want to read something from Kara McWilliams, and it's called The Fantasy History. And when I read it, I want you to take notes, but it mentions certain things, and I'll just read it. Long, long ago, the borderlands were settled by Spaniards, grantees, and caballeros, a gentle people, accustomed to the luxurious softness of fine clothes, to well-trained servants, and to all the amenities of civilized European living. Inured to suffering, kindly missioned padres overcame the hostility of Indians by their saintly example and the force of a spiritual ideal, much in the manner of a gentle spring rain driving the harsh winds of winter into the skies. Life was incomparably easy and idyllic in those days. There were none of the rough struggles for existence that beset the Puritans of New England. The climate was so mild, the soil so fertile, the Indians merely cast seeds on the ground, all where chance to deposit them and relax in the shade of the nearest tree while prevalent and kindly nature took over. Occasionally, when the field hands will interpret this siesta long enough to open up one's eye and lazily watch the corn stalks shooting up from the golden light. And of course, when he was writing this, it's a satire of this fantasy heritage. Talk about that. This reminds you of certain things about this history within North America, within the continent. There's some parallels with Canada, with the British Empire, and with the new colonies, the people back east, the first contact people, like east, the Caribbean, the Mexican Gulf, the Western coast. We're all first contact people, so we got the brunt of it.
Yeah.
Talk about to us, we just heard about this fantasy heritage. How does this narrative, this master narrative, fall into what the Pope, not only what the Pope was talking about, but a lot of these liberal individuals throughout the Americas, if not the world, is trying to, number one, are they trying to reassert their cloak over their losing flock? Or are they trying to create a narrative in which is, like I said, a performance par excellence of the platform and the media that they are presenting? A long question. Talk about the fantasy heritage.
Yeah, well, ultimately, it's always economic, right, Marcus? I mean, the creation of a narrative serves the developer of that narrative, right? And so, in that particular case that Kerry McWilliams is talking about, he's talking about this notion of the fantasy Spanish narrative, and it was one that was about taming California or taming the landscape in the minds of Americans to have them come west, right? And so crafting it in a way that folks that might settle in California could imagine themselves in this opulent, right? Tamed, absolutely tamed, fertile landscape, free of any kind of danger and risk. And if so, as you know, my work talks a lot about narrative, period, and how the erasure of the native narrative was handy for folks that were interested, that had economic interests in California, right? So if we were all gone, then we would no longer pose a threat. And in some cases, like at the big expos, the big world's fairs, if Native people were represented at all, they were represented as a possible workforce, right? They were represented as beautiful maidens that could be taken as wives, and well suited young men that could serve as ranch hands or in your plantation livelihood. And they crafted that narrative for everywhere that had indigenous people. And so the people of the Philippines were cast that way. Alaska was cast that way. California, absolutely. And so, yeah, it always precedes, the flooding of Western ideals and economy, and so it was important. California was seen as kind of wild frontier at one time, and so they had to craft this notion of this. The interesting thing that most people don't know is that the folks that actually colonized California were brown people. They were not white people from Europe. They were predominantly Native and African descent people from Mexico who were recruited by agents of Spain, but no one wanted to come to a distant outpost like Alta California. And so the reality was that it was a kind of a rugged place full of brown people. So the fantasy Spanish narrative has been so pervasive and so actually so successful that even the missions portray this notion that all of the missions were founded by white folks, and that they, you know, they brought the good word to the local Indian people, and everybody lived in harmony there, you know, that I, as you know, my dissertation research looked at how the 21 missions, perpetuate that narrative still, and the fourth grade curriculum is aligned with these ideas, and fourth graders visit the missions in their area along the coast of California, and that our actual history has been erased, and the history of the intermixing between Mexican Indian people and people of African descent with California Indian people, like you and I are descended from all of that mixture. Most of us don't have ancestry that goes back to Spain unless it's really far back. Most, you know, most of us have a mixture of that Mexican Indian ancestry and even African descent ancestry. So I'm actually in the middle, I might as well put a little plug in for an exhibition that I'm curating for the Autry Museum that'll open next November, and it'll be up for 2 years, called Reclaiming the Camino. And it's all about telling the actual story of the establishment of the missions along our road, along the road that we had been traversing for thousands of years for trade and interaction, and upsetting or disrupting that really dominant narrative that, you know, the road was created by the Spanish, and that the establishment of the road and the missions had some altruistic, non-economic goal, when the reality is that the goal was solely economic, and Spain utilized the church, first the Jesuits and then the Franciscans, to help them colonize so that they could extract all the resources from California and then bring their own people to settle it. Most people also don't know that you know, at its height, the mission system was sending millions of dollars worth of product to back to Spain, and that was all at the labor of Indian people, and at the detriment of our homelands, right? And in the process of smashing our culture and our life ways, and you know, beating the indigeneity out of our ancestors, and so that story needs to be told, and we're telling it at the Autry. It'll be at the Autry Museum for 2 years, and then we're hoping that it'll then go to the De Young in San Francisco after that. So the story, the real story, is starting to emerge, we've known it for a long time, but there are more people telling it in public spaces now than ever.
And that concludes the first segment of this two-part interview with Dr. Dina Dart, a citizen of the Coastal Band of the Chumash Nation. We're speaking on Pope Francis's recent apology to First Nations peoples up in Canada for the Canadian government and the church's role in cultural genocide in the operation of residential schools. And what does the apology mean for California Indigenous peoples from one particular perspective? You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
We didn't need any book. Then the Great Spirit met the Great Law. Indians are Jesus, hanging from the cross, hanging from the cross, in the name of their Savior, forcing on us the Trinity of the chain, guilt, sin, and blame. The Trinity of the chain, guilt, sin, and blame. Hanging from the cross, hanging from the cross. in a delusional grandeur. They lie to us, then lie to themselves about lying to us, about lying to us. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. In the name of the mother, the child, and the human spirit. Indians are Jesus. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. Where the rule of law is the law of rule. The law is a lie. The law is a lie. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. Their ego empire. The ethnic rich. Their cruelty of class. Imitation opulence. Crumbs that look like cake to the masses. Cake to the masses. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. We don't care who they think they are. They look like treaty makers to us, making one more promise, so they'll have another promise to break. Another promise to break. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. They keep asking us, what's wrong with us? We keep saying back, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you is what's wrong with us. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. Indians are Jesus. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross. In the name of the mother, the child, and the human spirit. Indians are Jesus. Hang from the cross. Hang from the cross.
Hang from the cross.
We weren't lost. And we didn't need any book.
The song Hanging from the Cross by John Trudell off the album Bone Days here on American Indian Airwaves. In the final segment of today's program, we continue with the second part of our interview with Dr. Dina Dart regarding Pope Francis's recent apology to First Nations peoples up in Canada for the Canadian government and the church's role in the operation of residential schools that resulted in cultural genocide. Our conversation focuses on a Chumash perspective and the role the Vatican played in the mission system and its legacy of cultural genocide against California Indigenous peoples. Dr. Dina Dart is a member of the Coastal Band of the Chumash Nation, the former curator of the Native American Collection at Portland Art Museum, and the founder of Live Oak Museum Consulting, an organization committed to reshaping museum narratives and assisting institutions in their efforts to be more accountable and responsive to Native American communities. This is Marcus Lopez speaking with Dr. Dina Dart on the significance and complications in the Pope's apologies regarding its violent legacy of cultural genocide.
I'm glad that you and look forward to the presentation, and I'm glad you're talking to that those missions were plantations, were economic plantations. That were reflected the feudal life of Spain and created even the Even a lot of people don't know that Chumash people were under the Fort Tejon Treaty that got ignored. That's the whole story that we covered here on American Indian Airways. But Chet, talk about, and this is what a lot of people, when I look at all the articles, want your view it, want your view on it, and that is the idea of an admission system, the minorias, the treatment of sexual abuse of the padres, from that going to all the way to even present about the sexual abuse of Catholic Church and the padres, variety of officialdoms, and from the ground level up to even some other levels. The Pope didn't talk about that. And I think a lot of, we need to refresh ourselves as far as what they did in the missions, and that completely was absent from the dialogue. Your comments on that, especially when topical now, and rightfully so, murdered indigenous women and LGBT communities. Please talk about that to us in reference to the church.
Yeah. You're right, and the church has rarely takes responsibility for its depredations in that particular area. In recent history, it's been mostly boys, right, young boys, but historically. Well, it's important to recognize first and foremost that the church was guilty of those depredations itself. You know, its representatives, the individuals that were aligned with the church, employed by the church, were the ones, you know, are the ones often committing those crimes. However, they also create an atmosphere in which women, LGBTQ communities are disempowered, also separated from their homes, right? Separated from their families and communities, which is what was happening at the missions. The women were literally women and young girls. I don't know if your listeners are aware of this, but there were women's, they call them today women's dorms, for all young unmarried women over the age of 8, had to stay in these dorms. They were called monjerios, at night. And the justification in the written documentation was that they were keeping them safe from the soldiers. But what was happening is that those women, not only were they being raped in the monjerios, they were also subject to these overcrowded conditions. And so the mortality rates in the monjerios was 10 to 1 what it was outside of the monjerios. So if you had a little girl who was turning 8 years old, you would, as parents, you would have to turn your little girl over to spend her nights in this, spend her days toiling, right, in the fields, and then her nights in the monjerio, knowing that she was either going to be raped or that she was likely going to die because the conditions were so bad. Has anybody ever taken responsibility for that? I mean, can you imagine that kind of trauma? And then that kind of trauma that gets passed down from generation to generation, all of those lost girls, and no one ever talks about that. No, certainly no one talks about that in the mission narratives. When I was doing my dissertation research, I interviewed the Park Service folks at La Purisima, because they actually have a building there that they call the Monjerio, and they speak about it to school groups as being, you know, this is where the girls went at night, and they do their crafts, and they, you know, they got to be with other girls, and they, you know, they painted in this ridiculously artificial positive light. And I confronted them, the two interpreters, Park Service employees in their little ranger outfits, you know, and and said, are you aware of the actual history? Oh, yes, of course we are. And they knew the actual history, but that they had made a decision to make it a G-rated version of the story because these were fourth graders. So instead of telling the truth, they actually could tell a complete lie, you know, and paint this notion that the priests were looking out for these girls and young women, and the opposite is true. I don't know what when we think about the enormity of the damage and trauma, I don't know what reparations look like, Marcus. You know what I mean? Like, how can we even talk about how to restore balance for the loss of all of those little girls? And you know what's even, excuse me, it's hard not, I mean, this, I get emotional in my work all the time. How can you not? But imagine that the loss of those little girls and young women, the way it's documented, there's this notion that they died of natural causes, and that they're, you know, so there's, they don't even get, and they don't get their, they never got their own graves, those little girls and young women, they never got their own graves. As we know, at the missions, they were all thrown into a big mass grave, an unmarked grave. So little girls just tossed in the trash every day, you know,
like
all year long for the duration of the time that the missions were in existence.
You know, just like just any other commodity, throw in the ditch, cover over, and move on. Yeah. Now, I wanted to ask you that. So, in that view, what would be some of the remedies that you would want to inform the listeners or inform, you know, the status quo as far as the church? What's the beginning phases of that? I know we're going to have a whole new show on that, which I don't want to at this point in time, but what are the kinds of things that, whether it be in Canada, because there's the similar things, the Baptist or the, you know, Protestant, we can't excuse them either. I mean, it's not just the Catholics, but yet, what do we want to see? A couple of things for remedies. Educate us, please.
Well, you know, a couple of beginning steps have sort of,
and we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Dr. Dina Dart, a member of the Coastal Band of the Chumash Nation, on the Pope's recent apology to Indigenous peoples up in Canada for the Canadian government and the church's role in its legacy of residential schools and cultural genocide, and what the apology means in terms of its significance and complications for Indigenous peoples. You're listening to One California Indigenous Perspective on the Pope's apology. And now back to the interview.
The first thing that needs to happen is that we need the stories. We don't even know the stories, right? Those stories were erased, and just like we were just talking, because they don't serve the capitalist machine. They don't serve the money makers. And so those stories have been completely erased. And so that's the first thing that has to happen, is that we need to unearth the narrative, the true narrative. And we see there are efforts in Canada and here in the US, and specifically in California, the Truth and Healing Commission. You know, I don't know how well those efforts are going. You'd have to sit down with a group of local Native people, of you know, First Nations folks, to ask if they feel like their stories are being captured in a way that really represents their grief and their trauma. My experience with the Truth and Healing Commission, is it commission or council there in California, Marcus?
It's a council.
My knowledge, because I live in Oregon, I haven't been very involved in those happenings that are spearheaded by the governor's office. I have been in touch with them so that we can make sure that the development of that narrative makes it into this California Indian Narrative Project that I and others have spearheaded, where we want to make sure that our stories, not just the stories of our trauma, but also the stories of our revitalization, including all of the activism and protection of sacred lands and cultural places that you yourself were involved, have been involved in since the 60s and 70s, that all of these stories, the stories of our, you know, the revitalization of our languages and the stories of the revitalization of our canoe. But yes, the stories of, you know, what we have endured, what we have survived, what our ancestors experienced, that a greater effort, what needs to happen is a greater effort to unearth those stories and make them the narrative, make them the dominant narrative is what needs to occur first.
And lastly, Dina, the question of the four little word land, what should we do? What's the proposals to the different institutions, including the Vatican? What do you see as your vision?
Yeah, it's a great question, Marcus. We're seeing land restored to indigenous ownership all over the country. And this is happening among larger governmental organizations. It's happening among corporations. It's happening among private landowners. And so many Native groups are positioning ourselves as land trusts and outfitting ourselves with land trust capability, even groups that don't have federal recognition, which is the case among most of the mission tribes, right, in California. And Sangre de Tay is one of the ones in California that has been successful as a indigenous land trust at receiving land back. And so land back is a movement and it includes us, right? And that is one way that the Catholic Church could make reparations, is to restore our ownership over some of those mission lands. There's still hundreds of acres in California that are managed by the diocese, either the local diocese or even the diocese in Spain. And like that parcel of land in Montecito is a perfect example. There's no good reason for the Catholic diocese to still maintain ownership of that land. Why shouldn't it be transferred back to us? So there are many models now to follow. There are, you know, hundreds of precedents that have been set. It could be a very straightforward thing to transfer land back to the indigenous peoples of California. And it could go a long way for us. I mean, as landless people, we have really suffered. We haven't been able to live together as a community. We have to live in places like Santa Barbara where the rents and the cost of living is exorbitant, right? I mean, most of our people can't afford to live in Santa Barbara, have to live in Lompoc or Somis, you know, in Ventura County, places that are, you know, are not Santa Barbara. And so that, you know, being able to live in community together is something that we haven't been able to do for a couple hundred years, and it's wrong. And we do, you know, we so the first step in that happening is that we receive some land back. You know, for a short time, one of the tribes along the coast had a small parcel of land, but the way it was zoned was that we couldn't live on it. Right. So the crazy thing is that there are these laws that continue to keep us from even living on our own lands. And you know, your listeners, the folks that are, you know, maybe they are members of the Catholic Church that can put pressure on their local diocese. Maybe they are business owners that can affect how policy is written in Santa Barbara County or in California. That there are action steps that folks can take at every level, and even, you know, there are tribes like the Duwamish Nation in Seattle and the Chinook Nation in Portland that actually have websites where they receive rent from the people who live there. Imagine that if Santa Barbara residents actually paid rent to us, we might be able to buy our own land at some point.
Not to say the part of the repatriation, not only land, but resources, oil and gold and gas and all those many, many other things that we're talking about, the accumulation of capital, accumulation of wealth, that the Native people, first people throughout the continent, and still going on in Mexico. We had a program last week on that, the mega projects up in Canada, the pipelines, the mineral extractions, and, you know, and all that that goes with that. But it's been a delight, by the way, speaking with you on these very important issues. And if people want to contact you, how can they contact you?
Just my first and last name at gmail.com. So it's DeanaDartt at gmail.com. And I also have a website, and it is www.liveoaknative.com. Live Oak Consulting is the name of the business. And if you're interested in decolonization trainings or any kind of museum work, equity and inclusion kind of work that really prioritizes Native values and goals, send me an email. Or if you want to talk about strategy, how to get land back to the coastal California people, I'm happy to talk about that too.
And that was Dr. Dina Dart in the second segment of our two-part interview here on American Indian Airwaves. She was speaking on a California indigenous perspective regarding the legacy of the Vatican and its mission system in relationship to Pope Francis's apology this past July 25th in Canada. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're going to conclude the show with a snippet from the California Indian Storytellers Association CD, When the Ancestors Whisper, Stories from Native California. In order, you hear from Daryl Babe Wilson, Ernest Siva, and Georgiana Sanchez in closing thoughts and wishes on California Indigenous stories.
All of the old stories, and they're not old stories, they're lessons in how to conduct yourself in life or in a situation, how to best that bad situation, the way Grandpa Ramsey would say, how to best the bad situation. But they always have a moral. Almost every story has a moral to it. The people sitting around listening, the kids listening.
Lamsa, he said, never forget who you are and where you came from, and don't forget your language, because the language retains it all. Not everyone followed that, of course, but those who did were able to keep certain things alive. If we're drifters, like, or lost people, as Lamsa said, you won't have any roots, you'd be lost. And we don't want to be lost.
To remember instead of to dismember, you know, to remember that as we are remembering, we are actually helping to heal generations of woundedness, you know. And so that is especially important for our own people. But the stories, especially in this day and time, I believe are for whoever happens to show up to hear them. You know, we tell them for our young people, but there's wonderful people who come and sit around the fire. And some of our old people say, you know, everyone that's here is meant to be here. So if they're sitting around the fire listening to the stories, they're supposed to be there listening to the stories, you know. And it might inform them too about what it is to be human in the world, so that when they go out and do whatever it is they do in the world, that they remember, you know, what it is to be human in the world. Yeah.
The moment of silence is over.
And that concludes our show for today here on American Indian Airwaves. A special thank you to our guest, Dr. Dina Dart. A special thank you to our musical guest, Aragon Star, Kupa Aina, John Trudell, the California Indian Storytellers Association, and the band Blackfire. American Indian Airwaves is mixed and mastered in the studio of Burnt Swamp Studio in Signal Hill, California. For Marcus Lopez, I've been your host for the hour, Larry Smith. Until next time.
Their heads. They sleep caged against their fear. They try not to become what they've endured. Wearing their souls on the thread. The moment of silence is over. Justify why your freedom manifests on their graves, and the blood never comes clean from their guilty minds, nor the hands that hold the chains. Silence is over.
KBOO, Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Does your employer have a matching gifts program? Many companies offer dollar-for-dollar matching charitable contributions for donations you make to KBOO. The impact of your gift may be doubled or possibly tripled. Participating companies also match gifts made by retirees and or spouses. Matching gifts are great.